IMRO's 2023 Best Local or Regional News Programme. The Voice of the Northwest, the 9 till noon show with Greg Hughes.
Good morning to you. Welcome back if you've been listening since 9. Thank you for all of your texts and WhatsApps and emails. Obviously, as you can imagine, a lot of people have been moved by Frank's situation. Frank, very sadly, lost his wife in January. His home has been condemned as well, and he's living in one room of that house. He's frustrated that he feels he hasn't got the support from the council or the state in his hour of need. There has been a rallying around him in terms of people trying to come up with solutions, but there are going to be other Franks out there. So I think what everyone would agree is that we need a system whereby this is avoided or there's interventions at the earliest level. And conscious too as well, as was mentioned in the first hour, that there is criticism of the scheme as is. Is anything ever going to be perfect? I'm not defending the scheme and I'm not critical of it either. It's not really for me. But there are people moving through it as well. And some caller mentioned in the first hour, and I think it would be interesting that if the scheme is working for you to have a chat with us. I understand it's maybe you just want to get on with it and get through it and move on with the rest of your life. But if the scheme has worked for you and is working for you, let us know as well. It might bring some comfort or hope to others. Good morning, Greg. I've visited Frank's home and I've made representations on Frank's behalf. I'll be meeting with Minister Alan Dillon to facilitate an emergency response for Frank and anyone else in this predicament. That comes in from Fine Gael Councillor Johnny McGuinness there. The DB said the DCB scheme needs inclusion, not exclusion. If we had housing and a functional system and good politicians, I bet we wouldn't be hearing from those begrudging immigrant or migrants. The change we need is those in local, national and European politicians. We cannot vote the same old faces back in time to weed the garden, says a listener. Where is the compassion and empathy gone in this country? The council's a joke that they can't distinguish a genuine case. This doesn't happen on an everyday basis. The council has come in for some criticism there from that listener. That's an absolute disgrace, that poor man. The government should look after their own first. Fair play to Paddy. Hope they get the support they deserve. The council should be ashamed of themselves. Just disgraceful. Paddy, keep on fighting the good fight. People like yourself are the only people will sort this mess out. 100% redress, nothing less. God bless you, Paddy. Putting Frank first, fair play to you. Another, that's terrible, Greg. The Irish get no help. You have to be foreign and you get everything. And you see, like, I mean, at the end of the day, there's plenty of resources and what have you if the will is there to help Frank. I don't think it's not like the resources are being taken away from him and given to someone else. And unfortunately, when cases like this come up, it is going to make people ponder those questions, which is something we've talked about extensively on this programme. It's plain to see the local minister has forgot about his grassroots when he's not standing up for the people. I mean, probably he's working in the background, I'm not sure. What a disgrace, that poor man. Government and DCC doing nothing and the ordinary people coming up trumps to help him. Problem is, it lets DCC off the hook. Well, there is a meeting, I think, was mentioned at 12 noon where Donegal County Council are going to come back with options. So whilst maybe it's a little bit far down the line, if that does happen, and there is a resolution, of course, we'll mention that as well. I don't know all of the ins and outs. Frank would break your heart listening to his voice. This government are a disgrace, housing everyone but the Irish. That's what's happening and it's only getting worse. I'm sitting in tears here listening to Frank and Paddy. This is just unreal. And everyone in DCC should be ashamed of themselves. This crisis needs attention. Well, not everyone in DCC. Listen, there's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of hard-working staff. They're all part of our community and our families as well. There isn't obviously a department that's responsible for this, and hopefully they're working on a resolution for Frank. A caller says, what a disgrace for that poor man. The authorities doing nothing and the ordinary people coming up trumps to help him. Caller says, what's happening with the brand new council houses laying unoccupied in Carndonagh? Can these not be offered to our own people in need like Frank? Another caller says there are houses lying vacant in Milford with no movement and other houses around the county lying vacant for the past 5 years. We've covered some of those vacancies and the reasons behind them. Can I just say we've been absolutely inundated with comments in relation to Frank's story. Hi, Greg. So sorry to hear Frank this morning. Heartbroken for him. Fair play to Paddy Diver for highlighting this case. If I could do anything to help Frank, I would. But surely to God, somebody must be able to help. Where and under God is the Donegal County Council. Please do something. Apparently they're working on it, and hopefully there's a resolution today. Listening to that poor man about his once called home now falling in on top of him, an absolute disgrace. Greg would take a tear from a stone. That's what it would do. To hear a man of his age breaking down like that. And some people wonder why people are protesting about our country being filled with people people fleeing war. Greg, get that in mind and getting everything handed into their hands, right, left and centre, and to listen to our own people like that man. I'm lost for words, honestly, a very bad start to the week. And on they go. We'll get to as many of those as we can over the course of the morning. You are tuned to the 9 till noon show here on Highland Radio. Let us see. We're going to take a message actually that came in via WhatsApp, and this is from a listener on some of the issues we've been talking about this morning.
Good morning. My name's Joy Beard. I've just been listening to the interview with Patty and Frank. Heart-wrenching, I suppose, is how you would describe it. I was honoured to spend a few hours with Frank the other day, and you know what he's going through is horrendous. The simple solution is to have the rent money up front for Frank to enable him to get himself sorted before his house is demolished. He's entitled to that money. He's living already in a condemned home. I don't see why that money can't be forthcoming so his plans can be put in place for Frank to make sure he's in a safe home as he watches his house being tumbled. I have to say the community's been great since the call out. I've had a few people contact me to say that they've got rooms free. I've a room myself, but my house is coming down as well. But it could be a temporary measure. But hopefully Frank will hear some good news today. But I just worry about how many more Franks are coming down the line with this crisis. There's no accommodation out there. Nothing forthcoming in the way of, you know, we do need to get the grant up front now for these families to be able to move on, because that's a massive hindrance. If you've not got your 15,000 euro to purchase a caravan or pay your deposit for your rent and your first month's rent up front, as well as paying your mortgage, some families just simply aren't going to be able to move on from this. But I'm wishing Frank all the best, and I really hope we get some good news for him now later on today.
All right, that's Joe Bird, who is a local election candidate, by the way, to be absolutely clear. We'll get the full list of election candidates in the next couple of days, and we'll give you some details as to when we will be hosting our debates. Everyone will be invited. Hopefully everyone can attend for both the European elections and the council elections. There's an awful lot of candidates, and it's going to take a little bit of organising, but hopefully we'll give you an opportunity to hear from everyone who is seeking your vote. And just to remind you, you can WhatsApp your voice notes to us on 086 60 25,000. Okay, well, we are being told that time and time again through surveys that homelessness, the housing crisis, is the matter to the fore of people's minds, I suppose, as we head into various elections. There's going to be three over the course of the next year at least. And the housing crisis affects different groups of people in different ways, albeit the same way, I suppose, in that they don't have a roof over their head. And domestic violence victims are being forced either into homelessness or back into abusive relationships because the housing crisis is leaving women and children who flee with simply nowhere to go. Dr. Marie Hainsworth is manager of Donegal Domestic Violence and joins us on the programme now. Good morning to you, Marie. Thanks so much for your time, as always.
Thanks, Greg. Great to have me here. Great for you to have me here. Thanks a lot.
Yeah. So what is the real world experience for people? What are you dealing with in terms of, I suppose, people, as we invite them to all of the time when we speak, to come forward at the earliest opportunity to seek assistance and help? But then, of course, the struggle to offer them somewhere else to live outside of that abusive relationship.
It has become more of a challenge. And I would say, I mean, I remember talking about the rising costs of rent prices, even like this time last year on the show, and I would say they have gone up another 20 or 30% since then. So In fact, I was just chatting with our accommodation worker recently, and you know, the cost of properties outside on the outskirts of Dublin now are the same price as Donegal. And yet, you know, HAP supports and other interventions are more readily available and higher rates are provided there. So it's just become a situation that is just getting worse and worse. You know, although there are properties out there, the cost of the rent is obviously kind of on a market level rate. So all costs of rents are going up. It doesn't really matter even what areas of Donegal you're in at the moment. We're not seeing a huge difference. So yeah, where do people move on to is the biggest challenge that we're facing at the moment. We do offer obviously units of emergency accommodation, but that is its role. It's not permanent housing. It's not social housing. We do need other move-on accommodation to be available in order for us to do our job most effectively. And that's where we're running into difficulties. And it's not just us, because we do link in, you know, the mental health services are in the same position, you know, housing bodies are in the same position. So nobody has got anywhere for people to move on to and free up properties that are needed.
Yeah, and I know it's not a competition between the various bodies that you mentioned, but yous are all competing for, you know, the same accommodation, and the cost is just, as you say, going through the roof. So you have sort of temporary measures, but it's moving people through that into you know, more permanent options is the problem.
Yeah, the main thing, you see, it used to be just waiting for people to be on the social housing list, because the housing list wait lists are, you know, you're looking at a number of years, certainly in Letterkenny, and that was the traditional challenge. And then people moving into private rented, that was not such a problem. We could move on. And that meant we could hold maybe social housing applicants for longer until those properties became available. But because of the increase in the rental market now, you're finding we're having to hold all of those families for a lot longer. So nobody is getting through the system. And even though we do offer interventions, we do offer some support to rent initially. We've been linking in with the rent supplement scheme, which is the national domestic violence rent supplement support. But all of those measures are short term again. You know, you're looking 3-6 months in a private rented accommodation with some additional supports, and then you're on your own facing market rates. So all of it is, you know, it's just struggling in the longer term. That's not that we can't offer emergency accommodation. We absolutely can at any moment. But it's the longer term picture that's the problem, you know.
What do we do about that? Or are we just really the victims of the housing situation? I mean, are there any... additional supports or measures that could be introduced specific to those who are victims of domestic violence?
Well, I suppose apart from the obvious, which is like building more social housing, which is the real problem, and also sorting out an immigration policy that's more streamlined and doesn't distort the housing market continuously or throw hurdles into it, you know, those two at a national level need to be sorted out. And if that was in place, you could then build in all the measures that are needed. But it's that lack of a coherent national framework for addressing homelessness, which is the biggest challenge. Everything else is piecemeal. We can put in, you know, I was reading about in Finland, I think they have interventions where you can put homeless people into units there, and there's mental health support, there's counselling support. So most people coming through long-term homelessness move on out of those units. We don't have anything like that here. There's no real social investment in terms of housing. It's just been seen traditionally as you just need a roof over your head and it's somebody else's problem. You know, whereas I think now the government really needs to sit down and get a handle on this, which it hasn't done. And local authorities need to get a handle on it as well, that it's not an issue that's going to go away. You know, you're going to have to be more proactive and put in place more creative investments and come up with different solutions. The way we're doing it is not going to work continuing going forwards.
What do we say to, Marie, what do we say to those that are living in, abusive relationships and might feel further trapped in them by these types of accommodations? You know, well, I'm going to have to stay because even if I do seek help, I'm never going to be able to afford rent on my own. And like, neither do you want to sort of discourage anyone from getting out of a situation that quite often escalates, you know. So what do you say to those that are currently in abusive relationships and feel trapped?
Well, never let that be the reason to stay, because we can, you know, we do work with families and we do move them on. It's just be prepared for the timeline of it. You know, I think everybody thinks, oh, get out of that relationship, move on with your life, and 2 months down the line, you're floating along as if nothing's happened. That's not how it's going to be. You're looking at, you know, a good 7 to 8 months, maybe in temporary accommodation, and then looking to find somewhere else. But we will do that. Like, we will be with you throughout that entire journey. We are also looking at other measures and supports. Like, we do offer security, additional things like cameras or panic alarms to try and support people to stay in their accommodation, because we know it's now too difficult to leave. There are other reasons not to leave as well. You know, a lot of people's family support is where they are. It's not necessarily where the refuge is or where safe housing is. So there are lots of reasons why we might support clients to stay, to get orders, to boost up security, to look at additional supports and resources going into that house. So it's not that there's just a one size fit all, but there are cases, obviously, where people do need to leave, do need refuge, and then obviously need to move on. And it's those scenarios that we're kind of talking about at this time.
And in the first instance, people can talk that through with Donegal Domestic Violence.
Oh, they can. And you can work with a worker and you don't need to leave a relationship straight away. You can work even while you're in that. Or, you know, it's just if you're thinking of, oh, well, I'll go and spend a couple of nights at a friend's house and move on somewhere else, you know, or if friends are encouraging you to do that, you need to think through the long-term repercussions of this. You know, you're not going to be sleeping on somebody's sofa and couch with a couple of kids for, you know, anything less than, you know, a number of months. So you do need to think through that piece, and it might be worth thinking about coming into refuge, whereas in the past you might not have considered that as an option, thinking it's not for you. But, you know, at least we can provide a self-contained unit and we can provide some respite whilst you look for other accommodation.
There are some accommodation centres in the county that previously has Ukrainians and still do, but some of the Ukrainians have moved on and there's vacancies there. Is that a suitable setting if it were offered to the likes of yourselves to accommodate victims of domestic violence?
Well, we have been, we do work with some of the developers around, you know, taking units within. We prefer self-contained units and we wouldn't ever be offering communal accommodation. So maybe some of those accommodation setups wouldn't be appropriate. But we do work certainly with developers. We move properties around. We have, you know, kind of temporary accommodation available in whatever part of the county people need. So, you know, we're definitely out there with a lot of the private developers as well. But it's those kind of things, yeah, that work. But it's not always, it does depend on clients and it depends on clients' needs as well. So this is the conversations we've had with developers. We can't necessarily take on your property at a particular time if we don't have a demand for it at the same time.
Yeah, I get you. And just finally, Marie, are you seeing any trends just in terms of the people that are coming seeking help or assistance or in terms of their numbers? Is there any increases, reducing, or is there any trends that jump out at you?
Yeah, I would say actually since January, just looking at our own statistics, there has probably been about a 30% increase in terms of not just requests for accommodation, but calls to the helpline and support work that we're doing with outreach. I know with outreach, we used to work with 70 or 80, you know, individual women a week. And that has gone up now. I think 1 week we hit about 120, you know, individual families that we were working with. So definitely the pressure on the service and the number of people coming forward, which is a good thing. You know, it's good that people are accessing the service. But no, across the board, across the county, different types of groups, we seem to be getting, you know, everybody. But it's definitely an increase. There's definitely more awareness. But there's certainly, you know, we'd be concerned about the level of violence that's out there as well. You know, we're hearing more extreme stories coming forward and more extreme types of abuse, which is not, it's not a welcoming sign at that level.
Okay. Dr. Marie Hainsworth, thank you as always for helping us understand exactly what's going on in this area. We do appreciate it. That's Dr. Marie Hainsworth, manager of the Donegal Domestic Violence Service. And obviously, domestic violence victims are being forced in cases into homelessness, but also to quite worrying to hear of a 30% increase since January in contacts in relation to domestic violence. Now we're joined on the programme by Councillor Jason Barr. Good morning to you, Councillor. Thanks for your time.
No problem. Good morning, Greg.
A bit of a shock over the weekend. You announced you were resigning from the SDLP. You're going to continue to work for your continue your work as an independent within the council. Why did you make this decision and how long had you considered it before you announced it?
Okay, first of all, obviously, this decision, yes, was made this morning. And it was, can I just say that it was a very, very difficult decision, and I didn't make this decision and I didn't take this decision too easily. So, obviously, I'm the current Deputy Mayor of Derry City and Strabane District Council. And this June, we now have the Mayor for the next year. So, of course, 2 weeks ago, or sorry, within the start of the year, I let members know that I'd be putting my name forward for Mayor. And then in the past couple of weeks, the process started to then obviously select the Mayor. So what happened was we were sent an email that thanks very much for putting your name forward. There will be a selection convention, which was supposed to take place this evening at 6:30 p.m. in Harbour House in Derry. And three names were named on that email that went to 308 members across the Foyle and West Tyrone constituencies. On that, it explained that each member would have one person, one vote, and they would decide the Mayor. At no stage was it known that there would be an interview process and that candidates would not make it through the interview process to any of the members, nor was that relayed to myself, Shauna Cusack or Lillian. So we were then told, yes, there would be an informal interview, which took place last Monday evening, and we were asked five questions, which I feel I did answer very well. Mm-hmm. And then I got a phone call an hour later to say, oh, sorry, we're only putting one candidate forward and two of these didn't make it. And I was going, right, there's something not right here, because members always decided who was the Mayor across Derry and Strabane. So I felt very let down by the party. Obviously, as a sitting current Deputy Mayor, to be told, sorry, not good enough to go forward for the Mayor. And then obviously another sitting councillor who has been there 11 years, again, to be told, sorry, not good enough, was more or less just a kick in the teeth. So obviously I was very hurt. And then which basically led me to my decision over the weekend was that during the week I heard absolutely nothing. I had no reach out from the leadership, nobody from party management, nobody at all from headquarters reached out to see how it was about the decision, to explain the decision that they took on this. And then they find out on Friday night, Craig, that we also have the Mayor and Newry Moreland Down Council area this year, and none of their candidates were interviewed. And headquarters of the party didn't interfere in their process at all. So it seems to be one rule for one area and none for another. And basically, I joined the party 10 years ago under the social democratic values that exist within the party. But unfortunately, when one of those values are removed, as in the democratic process for members, then unfortunately I just can't sit under that banner no longer.
Was it ever explained to you as to why the process changed? Because it's not obviously right across the north, because you've given an example where the situation that was there before continues. Yep. So were you or Councillor Cusack, for that matter, told why the process had changed?
No, we were just told that new procedures were in place. But then to hear that, no, in fact, they weren't in place because it didn't happen elsewhere when mayors were being selected for the party. So to me, these procedures were just put in place in Derry and Strabane, which to me is a joke. And to me, it was just a chaffing session. And I cannot sit on this and say, be a part of a party that has flawed processes which never existed before. And the members, their outcry from the members right across the district and the anger, and they've all relayed their anger and disappointment at how this process was continued. And I want to make something very, very clear. Greg, the selection convention was supposed to be tonight. If I wasn't selected by members tonight and one of the RTU colleagues were selected, I would have been the first to raise their hand and congratulate and support them for the year going forward, because that's the way it's always been. If I wanted to stand for a chairperson of a committee, we went through, our members or council colleagues would have voted. It's always been democratically done, and for that to be removed, I could not be part of it. But I will say, it's got absolutely nothing, I want to categorically make this very, very clear, Craig, that it's got nothing to do with who the new mayor is. Me and Lillian get on very, very well. We will continue to get on very well, and I know that she will be an absolutely fantastic mayor for everyone across Derry City and Strabane District Council.
No, I don't doubt
really
that, but in a way, for some, or maybe for herself, hopefully we'll get an opportunity to speak to her at some point, but in a way, it kind of tarnishes... I don't know what the right word is, but it might take away from the achievement given the sort of fallout from it. I think to stand in front of the 300 plus members to win that vote and then to go on and be mayor, it might feel, you know, a little bit more democratic and representative. Yeah. So In terms of the interviews then, was that just a waste of your time? Was that just a ruse? Because was really anything you said in that meeting considered, or was it just a box-ticking exercise to eliminate two of the candidates?
Well, you made a very good point about the tick box exercise. So that's what we thought that this was. Like, I was told by, people were saying to me, "Oh, congratulations going forward on your selection and looking forward to the selection convention." And I've said to the people within the party, "Oh, you have to get through, apparently I have to get through an interview process." "Oh, don't be worrying about that. That's just going to be a tick box exercise, part of procedures. Don't be worrying about that. You'll all get through it. There'll still be a selection convention." Then we told, no, that's not how it works, unfortunately. But that didn't sit well, obviously, with me or Councillor Cusack or the vast majority of the membership.
Is this done and dusted now at this point? It's set a precedent as well. What happens now for when this comes up into the future again? What happens in other districts in Northern Ireland? Do you know what I mean? Is this the new SDLP policy, or was it just something that was fashioned specifically for this election? It just leaves so much many questions rather than answers.
I know. Yeah. Oh, trust me, and I have so many questions, and I'm still yet to get the answers, Craig. Trust me, I know. That on that, but as I say, to me it just was set for this area, like as I say, to hear other districts not even having that type of procedure even on them from, or even any interference at all from party headquarters was disappointing to hear, to be honest. As I say, this is a very disappointing day for me, very disappointing day for the party, but also a monumentous day for the party, and I'll not take this away from the party. You know, I announced I was resigning today. They also announced that Lillian would be the mayor today. So, but that they can do, they've every right to do that. And as I say,
that's fine, and that's gracious of you. But that being said, again, you know, do the SDLP, will they keep minutes of the meeting? Presumably there was a meeting to actually select the successful candidate. Those minutes could be quite telling in that it might point as to why either you or Councillor Cusack weren't put of before members, you know, so there would be a democratic vote on this. You know, that could be quite an interesting read if such minutes exist.
Yeah, well, exactly. Well, that's something that I can surely find out if there is minutes that existed from that meeting. But even if there is minutes from that meeting, Craig, my point is an interview process never existed before. It was always the members that decided. So even if the minutes come out of this to say that hypothetically Lillian scored 31, Shauna scored 30, Jason scored 29, you know, it's still, to me, a management committee should not be deciding if you're eligible to go forward for mayor. They should be looking at your track record as a councillor. There's the sitting deputy mayor. He's done a great job of the year. At least give him a run at the membership to let him let them decide. There's another councillor. She is 11 years elected. Again, fantastic on the ground. Let the members decide. Look at Lillian's fantastic track record with the party and what she's done. Again, she deserves to go forward to the membership like they have always decided. The first citizen for the Derry City and Strabane District Council area.
Okay, just finally, is this a decision made by the party locally, or does this go all the way up to the head office, as far as you're aware?
What decision? That's right.
The decision to change the process, the decision to eliminate you and Shauna, so that effectively there was one person selected for this position.
Yeah, so this was obviously a management committee. Mm. This was a management decision, yes, party management decision.
Okay, Councillor, and I'm sure you're keen to point out that you might have resigned from the SDLP, but you're continuing work as an independent. Bridges be rebuilt at this stage, or is this slap in the face so severe?
Listen, I have not fallen out with the party on this, and especially the party local. It's the grievance I have with party headquarters and party management. I get on very well with the party locally, the local MLA in Strabane. I have a lot of time with the local MLA in Strabane and his team, and of course my ex-colleagues within Derry City and Strabane District Council, all nine of them. I have respected them all well, and I will continue to respect them going forward.
Okay, well, thank you very much for your time. I appreciate you speaking to us, Jason. Take care of yourself. That's Councillor Jason Barr there. And congratulations to Councillor Lillian Barr, who is the new mayor. But obviously, and Jason was the first to congratulate her, but obviously I think people might understand as to why that would leave a sour taste in the mouth of both Councillor Barr and Councillor Shauna Cusack, who was supposed to be going before party members this evening. Right, okay. Now we are talking to Julie Egan from Donegal Town. Good morning, Julie. Thanks for joining us. Good to see you.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Thank you joining us. All right, now you originally from Killarney, but you're Donegal through and through now. I suppose we'll claim you.
Yeah, well, I'm actually originally Pettigo in Donegal.
It's only up to
I spent 16 years in Killarney, so yeah, and then back to Donegal again.
Right, okay, and you've an interesting story for us, Julie, in that you underwent a simultaneous kidney and pancreas transplant. How rare is that, that there'd be a double transplant like that?
It's pretty rare. Your chances aren't the highest of getting it, so they're not as available as like the kidney transplants or other organ transplants. Yeah, the pancreas is just a very complex one as well, and it's just more of a rarity.
And so, what led to you requiring this transplant medically, Julie?
So I was type 1 diabetic since childhood, and that led to, I basically used to call myself a walking complication. I had every single complication by the time I'd hit my late 20s from the disease and the illness. So basically I had severe blindness, problems with my eyes, all the kind of eye complications, and then the kidney failure as well, down to type 1 diabetes. And together with everything, they suggested that for like a brighter future and, you know, to possibly save my vision and things like that, that I would need the pancreas and the kidney. So that's what led me to get the double transplant.
Yeah, and you got that news really early. I mean, teenage years can be tough enough, but this turned your life on its head, I'm sure, in terms of hospital treatments and your general health and what have you.
Yeah, it was. It was just kind of, I always kind of struggled growing up. I was always ill. It was just a thing about me, you know. Anybody that knew me knew that I was like in and out of hospital or, you know, her diabetes is off the rails again, you know, things like that. But it was in my mid-20s and I thought like things were more kind of, I had more of a grasp on things and things were settling and I was doing quite well. And then I was just hit with all that. First, it was the vision loss, the blindness and the complications there and undergoing rigorous treatment to save the vision. And then as soon as that started to settle and I had like a major operation for the vision as well, after that started to settle, then I started showing signs of kidney failure and straight away, basically. So it was from one thing into the next. Yeah. And then that just progressed then onto dialysis.
Yeah. So you had your physical battles. What was the mental toll on you? How did you cope?
So as a teenager, especially, I was suffered like more from depression and anxiety. And I've always kind of had a bit of anxiety, like even to this day. I don't think that's something that you can get rid of, you know, as people know well, but you learn to manage it better, you know. So those were the two kind of major battles for it as well, was just the anxiety and depression. And but I do have a kind of general positive outlook on life. I have a good sense of humor. I feel like that really helped me along the way.
But it's kind of stages you went through, didn't you? Because obviously you went through but that created a new you, your battle with anxiety and what have you, and you became quite stubborn on it, didn't you? And particularly independent. Talk to me about that stage of your life.
Yeah, I just, like when I was a teenager, I became, I guess, more rebellious, or even more than the average teenager, as you'd say, as my parents would well know, the poor things. But I tried to live independently, like in Cork and things like that. And I was kind of adamant that I would just trooper through until I got wiped off my feet, which I did. But, you know, I was always kind of like that. I'm always very independent. I go to all appointments by myself. I don't like to involve people too much into what's going on with me. I don't feel like I need to bring that around everybody. Like, you know, I just kind of go and do my thing and revert back with the news. And that's kind of just the way.
Yes, I get you. But I suppose getting closer to home too, as much as you want to dip in and out of it, it's nice to have that sort of support structure around you that facilitates sort of that independent way you have of doing things.
100%. Yeah. My family have always been great and very supportive of everything. So they're great.
Brilliant. Yeah. So what age did you go on the list then, the transplant list? And was it for both a kidney and pancreas from the get-go?
Yeah, it was both from the get-go. So it took a while now to get on the list. I was 4 years in total on dialysis, and it wasn't until the third year I was on the list because I just had so many things happen to me when I was on dialysis as well. And the biggest one was COVID-19. I ended up on a ventilator for over 30 days.
Oh, wow.
So I nearly didn't come out of that. And that really is what put the spanner in the works with them, because you have to go through a lot of health testing. You have to be fit enough for transplant, you know, and COVID completely wiped me out and I had to kind of start again and build myself up. And then, but I was only 6 months on the actual list then in the end. So that was a very short time to be on the list. So yeah, I was very fortunate.
And how does that work that you find out there is a possible match? How do you find out that information?
So you're in contact with your what are called transplant coordinators. Mine were down in St. Vincent's Hospital in Dublin. So you're kind of in contact with them regular, but basically when there's suitability comes up for organ, they call you on your phone. Like, you have to have your phone on you 24/7. You can't have it on mute. You just have to take it everywhere you go, no matter what you're doing, just because you never know when you're going to get that call. So yeah, you get a phone call from the nurse and she says, "Where are you? What are you doing?" I said, "I was at my dad's house at the time, so minding my nieces." And then she was like, "Yeah, we think we have it for you, so get on down to Dublin." And that was it. It was a race down to Dublin then. So
what is it like waiting on that call? Because I suppose at one minute you're looking at the phone saying, "Bloody hell, would you ring?" And then at the same time, it's like, "Oh, what happens when it rings?" Do you know that sort of way? Because it changes everything, doesn't it, in that split second? It's like, we're going to Dublin.
You kind of, when you see the Dublin number, like I had obviously Vincent saved on my phone, and I mean, you keep in contact with them, but you don't really get that many phone calls with them. It can be like a text or something. So when I saw them pop up at the time of day they rang as well, my heart sank, like, because I knew what it was, and I answered the phone. And as soon as I heard Caroline's voice, and it just had that tone to it as well, of like kind of excitement, you know. And I don't even really remember it. I think it's a bit of a blur because it was such a shock, you know. And the kids were there looking at me saying, "What's happening?" And I was like, "I don't know." And it was just a bit of craziness, you know. So, but it was a great feeling. Like, yeah.
And like, the difference is almost immediate, isn't it? When you woke up from what you had been through, for the majority of your life, effectively, what was the feeling when you woke up? Were you aware that it had been the success that it is?
Yeah, when I woke up, I kind of looked around me and went, "Oh, right, I suppose it went well." And I was kind of, the doctors came in within a few minutes and they were like, "If you can, get out of the chair, get out of the bed and the chair." And I was like, "Yeah, get me out of this bed," you know. It was just excitement and disbelief, really. I was kind of, I guess it didn't really hit either, though, until I was kind of in there a few days. And I was like, "Oh, wow, this actually happened." And but instantly, though, I had this feeling of vitality. Like, I felt like I could get out of the bed and go for a walk, you know.
Yeah.
And that was within a few hours post-surgery. So
we're all different in how we deal with things. So what your experience of this question I'm going to ask might be different to someone else's, or maybe there's an awful lot of commonality. But at what point do you sort of start saying, "Right, actually, the reason I feel like this is because of someone else's selfless act"? They had opted to donate their organs. Like, that is that something that has to be worked through and processed in your mind? Is it tough to come to terms with, or to figure out exactly what's going on in that regard?
Definitely, yeah. That's something I still haven't fully processed. It's been a year, but it's still something I think about every single day. It's, yeah, like you said, it just kind of comes and hits you sometimes, and you kind of take a step back and go. But it just gives you that overwhelming kind of sense of gratitude, but also a bit of grief, you know, because you know that someone had to pass away for you to continue on living a more healthy life. And that's kind of, it's not a nice thought to have, but it's the reality.
Yeah, but that's their gift to you. That was their choice, which I think is amazing. They decided to say, "I am actually going to gift other people. You're the recipient of that gift." It's, which I think is a wonderful, beautiful thing. And also too, you know, I'd say you put up some miles on the clock for treatments and hospital appointments and dialysis and what have you. Not the type of miles you want to do. You want to do a lot of travelling and what have you. Obviously, you couldn't have done much of that in the past because you're constantly sick or rooted to an appointment here, there, everywhere. Is that something now you're hoping to be able to pursue now that you have this new gift of life?
Oh, 100%, yeah. I've already been... I just finished my first year of college there, and part of it was 3 weeks work experience in Malaga, in Spain. So I've already been out of the country and spent 3 weeks away. It was absolutely amazing. That's something I never would have been able to do before, even when I was diabetic and just kind of battling with diabetes. It's just something that I never progressed to do. And yeah, there's been a couple trips had and plenty planned. So it's
but it
just
must
amazing
feel strange to be able to look towards the future with some level of certainty. That must be strange because you've never had that in your adult life.
Never had it. Like I said, it's still all new, all these feelings and emotions, they're still all new and I'm still processing them every day. But like, it's like a whirlwind of just like happiness and just disbelief and just absolute gratitude to my donor and their decision to do what they did. Like that's something that just overwhelms every emotion that I have.
Yeah, for sure. And we're speaking in the context of the Human Tissue Bill, which was signed into law by President Higgins earlier this year, towards the end of February. And it is seen as a milestone. Effectively, everyone will be on the register as donors, and then people may choose to opt out. I don't see that as a negative thing in that it brings any level of compulsion into it. I think it just makes us think about this in a different way, and maybe even say, right, I'm going to think about this, and if people want to opt out, that's fine. But by default, you've opted in, and I think maybe it will change the way we have the conversation about organ donation.
Yeah, I think so. The families will still be asked for consent as well, you know. So it's really still down to having the conversation with your family and just making your wishes known. So that then they're, if God forbid, like, but when they're in that position, you know, so that they can confidently make a decision knowing that you were okay with it or
it's so
you weren't
important.
Okay with
it really is so important to have that conversation really clear where you're in good health and say, look, I want to give someone else the gift of life or vision or whatever it might be. And it's a simple enough conversation, and it's a positive one too. It's not negative. You hope it never happens. Yeah. But if it does, you're able to help others.
Yeah, 100%.
And you're here and healthy over the head of that, really, which is absolutely fantastic. And now in terms of just your going forward, right, is that you sorted now? The organs are at home now with you and... They've adapted to your body and that's it? Or what happens going forward now?
Yeah, like for the first year, you're constantly going to clinics, just you're constantly getting your bloods done, making sure everything is okay and everything's been accepted. You're never out of the woods when it comes to rejection fully, like, but you're just keep up with your medications. Every 6 months to a year, then go to clinics would be transplant clinic. Things like that, where they do rigorous blood tests, so they monitor you very closely, but also not too invasively. Like you have your freedoms again, and it's they do what they need just to make sure that doesn't happen.
And I hope you don't see it as a private question, but a couple of callers want to know: do you still have diabetes?
No, technically no. I don't have diabetes, so I don't no longer have to monitor my diet. As to say, I still do a bit. You know, I don't think that'll ever leave me, but. Don't have to do insulin injections regularly, and glucose monitoring is something I just don't have to do. Maybe once in a while. It's complete freedom.
Excellent.
Really,
well, brilliant stuff. And the reason you're speaking and the reason you're sharing your story is it's part of the campaign, isn't it? The IKA are backing it as well, as they always do. Share your wishes. Have the conversation. Make it incredibly clear, because in that moment, in a sudden death, it's hard to think straight, you know, when you're asked these types of questions. So it's imperative that everyone that might have a say in this knows exactly what you want.
Yeah, 100%.
Brilliant.
It just puts minds at ease.
Okay, Julie, it's been great having you on the show. Thank you very much indeed. And it's great to hear you doing so well. You put your time in, let's put it like that, since the age of 11. So it's great that now you have that freedom and hope and future and able to pursue everything that you want to. Thanks for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Bye-bye.
Cheers.
Take care of yourself. Bye-bye. That's Julie Egan from Donegal Town, originally Pettigo.